It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We have invitations out to all six members of Iowa's congressional delegation in Washington to share their thoughts during these first weeks of the Trump presidency. Last week, we heard from Steve King, a staunch Republican from Iowa's 4th District in western Iowa. Today, a conversation I had this morning with Dave Loebsack from Iowa's 2nd District. Loebsack is the only Democrat in Iowa's entire congressional delegation. Iowa's 2nd District, that's roughly the southeast corner of the state. It includes the cities of Davenport, Ottumwa, Clinton, and Iowa City. Loebsack has been serving since 2007 and was just reelected to his 6th term. Congressman Loebsack, welcome back to our program.
It's always good to be here, Ben. Thank you.
Let's have you react to some of the news just out. President Trump has appointed Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster as his new national security advisor. Said to be a widely respected military strategist, known for challenging conventional thinking, also helping to turn around the Iraq War. Your reaction to this pick?
I think it's a good pick. I think it's important that President Trump get folks like him in there because President Trump is going to need some adults in the room, as they say. President Trump does not have any national security experience at all, as we know. And it's good for him to have folks who do have that experience. And, you know, clearly the people he's chosen to be on his national security team, many of them do have a lot of good experience. I think it's going to be important to keep a check on some of the other folks, especially Bannon, who is the first political person ever to serve on the National Security Council. He's a political strategist. He's not a national security expert. So I think it's good to have those folks there as part of the National Security Council. My only hope is that the Secretary of Defense, the Chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, these folks will be regular members of the National Security Council, not just intermittent members of the National Security Council. It's very, very important, in addition to the National Security Advisor as well.
Well, what's your overall reaction, Congressman, to the first month of President Trump's office?
Well, as you might imagine, I really believe it's been chaotic. I think we have someone in the presidency who didn't expect to be elected president. I don't think most of the country expected him to be elected president. And he was. I think it was a surprise. I think it's been very difficult for him and the folks around him to put a team together. You know, clearly there have been some delays as far as the confirmation process is concerned. There's no question about that. But a large part of that had to do with the fact that a lot of his nominees were not submitting the required paperwork as far as financial disclosures are concerned. It's been a rough start. It's been a chaotic start. It's been fits and starts, if you will. Mm-hmm. I hope that that can change in the coming weeks. Even once he gets his cabinet in place, there are going to be a lot of other people below the cabinet-level officials who are going to have to be appointed. Many of them are going to have to be approved by the Senate as well. And there's no indication at this point that they've got very many people in mind at all to fill those positions. So I just think whatever your political party affiliation may be, I think it's important that we recognize that we've got to have a functioning government. And that's not the case so far, and it's really quite unfortunate. There are a lot of reasons for that. There's a lot of blame to be placed on a lot of different sides, but clearly President Trump and the immediate people around him, I think, have demonstrated a level of incompetence that we haven't seen in modern times.
Mm-hmm. Give me an example that stands out in your mind, an example of two when you say level of incompetence. What?
Well, just the fact that they're unable to put a team together and put it together in a timely fashion, getting rid of General Flynn, for example, as early as he did within the first month. I mean, that's unheard of. That sort of thing. He should be picking people who are good for the positions, who will be approved by the Senate, who will, in fact, bring their own level of competence to the job and will not be mired in scandal and in all kinds of other issues that we've seen so far among a number of these folks.
Mm-hmm. Since you mentioned Michael Flynn, the shortest-serving national security advisor in history, let's talk about some of those revelations of connected with Russia. Of course, before that, we had the Russian meddling in the election, as seen by our U.S. intelligence agencies, right, which I'm sure you've had some briefings about. Are you satisfied in terms of the meddling in our elections? Are you satisfied with how this is being handled in Congress?
Well, right now, the intelligence committees in both houses, in each house, are of course, doing their own investigations. I think it would be important for us to have something that's non-political, non-partisan, an independent commission set up so we can find out exactly what did happen.
How likely is that?
I don't think it's very likely at the moment, but we do have some Republicans in the U.S. Senate, even some in the House, not so much in the House, willing to speak out publicly. But I have spoken to a number of members of the Republican Party in the U.S. House who have a lot of concerns about this, but they have not spoken up at this point. But we've seen John McCain and Lindsey Graham. Those folks have spoken up. Ben Sasse from Nebraska, for example, he's been very outspoken about a lot of these issues. I don't know that the chances are very good, but I think we have to continue to press for that because I think it's important to find out exactly what happened in the election. And I'm not one who's going to make the argument that the Russians necessarily, because of their influence, determined that Donald Trump would be president of the United States. I think we need to find out exactly what they did, what they tried to do, what the effects were.
Back to the election, what do you make of Donald Trump's repeated insistence that massive voter fraud allowed Hillary Clinton to win the popular vote?
Right. Well, there's no evidence for this whatsoever. We have seen a lot of studies that have been done in the past, academic and otherwise. There have been a number of Republican secretaries of state around the country, including right here in Iowa, who have said that there is no vote fraud, voting fraud. There are a few examples. We have a couple of examples here in Iowa, and it was a Trump supporter who voted more than once, of all things. You may have heard that story, and she claimed that she's mentally incapacitated, and that's why she did it. But there's nothing widespread. We have no evidence whatsoever for this. In fact, Donald Trump's former campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, just yesterday said that there were no buses, never have been any buses coming from Massachusetts into New Hampshire with folks who are voting illegally. So there's nothing to these claims whatsoever.
President Trump plans to issue a revised version of his temporary travel ban targeting majority Muslim countries. Could be as early as today. Reports tell us it's likely to focus on fewer people so that it will survive legal challenges. The new order, according to the AP, would focus on the same seven countries, but would only bar entry to those without a visa, those who've never entered the U.S. before. Also, unlike the original order, people from those countries who have already permanent U.S. residency, if they have green cards, they would not face any restrictions. Does this fix the problem in your eyes?
I have to wait and see exactly what it says. The original ban, of course, did affect those with green cards. It was, I believe, in effect, a ban on Muslims. I think that was the wrong thing to do. It's not only wrong from a humanitarian standpoint, it was wrong. And if it continues to be along those lines, it's wrong from a national security standpoint. There are many, many folks on both sides of the aisle who have made, I think, the proper argument that by banning these individuals from these countries, we're going to be creating more enemies than we're going to be able to prevent, from coming into this country and doing harm to our citizens. Our national security has to be our first concern. There's no question about that. But we already have a number of procedures in place. We're not seeing folks come from those countries who are doing us harm. We know that for a fact. And we have to be very, very careful, too, that a net is not cast so widely that it is, in effect, a Muslim ban. That's not going to do us any good when it comes to recruiting allies in the region who will be helping us, not to mention making sure that our Muslim brothers and sisters here in the United States are helping us in their communities too, if we have folks who are trying to do us harm. So I haven't seen, obviously, he hasn't released it yet, but I will be looking at it very carefully. But I want to make sure that, this thing doesn't do more harm than good and it does, in fact, protect America.
This is a conversation with Dave Loebsack from Iowa's 2nd District, just reelected to his 6th term in Congress. Let's talk about Obamacare, one of the pledges by the Republicans as part of our last campaign. Your Republican colleagues in the U.S. House say that they'll soon introduce their legislative plans to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. What can you tell us about what's going on in the House in terms of that repeal and that replacement?
I wish I could tell you what's going on in the House, seriously, Ben, but the latest that I have seen is basically an outline as far as a replacement, and there are precious few details actually attached to that outline. It's not even clear to me, for example, that they're going to keep the individual or the employer mandate or they're going to get rid of it. They have said they're going to remove the penalties attached to the mandates, but I want to know, are you going to get rid of the mandate? They claim that they would like to, you know, keep some of the popular provisions of Obamacare, of the Affordable Care Act, like keeping your children until age 26 on your insurance, making sure that you can't be discriminated against because of pre-existing conditions. A lot of that remains very unclear as far as what they will be proposing. I'm on the Energy and Commerce Committee. I'm hopeful that when we come back, we will see what their alternative is. That will come before our committee eventually. I will have to vote on that before it goes to the full House. I have said all along that I have not seen any adequate replacement for Obamacare up to this point. I want to see what that replacement is. I want to see the specifics. So far, what I've heard from them is that what they have offered is wholly inadequate. It doesn't deal with the problems that we tried to deal with in the Obamacare legislation. It doesn't protect folks with pre-existing conditions. It doesn't keep those young adults on their parents' insurance till age 26 and any number of other things. When they talk, for example, about expanding health savings accounts, health savings accounts are great if you have the money to put into a health savings account. But most people I talk to, when I'm on the road, I'll be on the road today, I will be asking people at the convenience stores when I stop what they think about this. And I would suspect a number of them are going to say, you know, health savings accounts sound good, but I can't even make the 401k match that's offered at this convenience store, let alone put some money into a health savings account and have that be in lieu of health insurance. It doesn't make any sense.
Congressman Loebsack, you've reintroduced some legislation, the Sergeant Brandon Ketchum Never Again Act, to address veteran suicide in this country. Tell us what that's about and your hopes of having it pass.
Well, you know what happened to Sergeant Ketchum. At least we've heard in the media what happened with Sergeant Ketchum when he came to get care here at the VA facility. He committed suicide. He was not able to get in, and we still don't know all the details. I want to be very fair to the VA. The Inspector General has not submitted their report to the public yet, so we don't know all of the details around what happened. But the bottom line is, as far as I'm concerned, and the Democrats and the Republicans in the U.S. House who've co-sponsored this bill are concerned, is that no veteran should ever be denied mental health care. If a veteran goes to a VA facility, either a big hospital or a community-based outpatient clinic, whatever the case may be, and they believe that they are suicidal and they request an inpatient bed, they should be able to get a bed. And if there's not one available at the facility, the VA will find one for them. That's what that act does.
Do you, in this case of Brandon Ketchum, do you think that there was a lack of beds that made him be turned away?
I'm going to withhold judgment on it until we get the Inspector General's report. I have read the records myself, but I think it's best for me to withhold judgment on it. I will say that the VA in Iowa City, the VA in Des Moines, our community-based outpatient clinics, overwhelmingly do a very, very good job as far as dealing with our veterans and giving them the kind of care that they need. There are, you know, there are lapses from time to time, and we just have to make sure that those lapses are few and far between, and I'd rather they never happen.
Congressman Loebsack, I'd like to ask you about a couple things happening in the state legislature that overlap with goings-on in the federal area. After failing to approve an increase in the state's minimum wage last year, several Iowa municipalities and counties proposed local increases. Iowa City, Wapello County, I think before this conversation, you said that you're actually going there today, Linn County. And now the Republican-controlled legislature in Iowa is proposing legislation to roll back those local ordinances in favor of a statewide minimum tied to the federal minimum.
Well, we have an uphill battle both in the state and at the federal level as far as increasing the minimum wage from $7.25 to $10 or $12 or $15, wherever it may end up eventually. We have an uphill battle because Republicans in Iowa, Republicans at the federal level, simply refuse to increase minimum wage. That's what's happened here at the state level, as you know. What the Republicans have argued here at the state level is it shouldn't be a local decision. It should be a state decision. Well, there's a lot of inconsistency as far as I'm concerned, because that's a principle that doesn't always apply when it comes to other kinds of issues. And so it suits their purposes in this case, unfortunately. What I know is that no one who's working 40 hours a week should ever live in poverty. And that's what we're talking about here with $7.25 an hour. I'm not optimistic that we're going to be able to move it up significantly in the near future, but we've got to do it. There is a huge movement out there in America demanding we do that. There are a lot of other things that that movement is demanding. But clearly, the minimum wage is something that, you know, we should have increased a long time ago because we shouldn't have people be living in poverty.
After the 2010 census, Iowa was redistricted to four districts, down from five. As you know, Iowa has been held up as an example to the rest of the country for a tremendous nonpartisan approach to redistricting. Now, some Democrats in the legislature are concerned that with Republicans controlling both chambers in the Iowa legislature, as well as the governor's office, there may be a move to change this process of redrawing Iowa's political boundaries, making the process resemble the highly partisan process in other states. Do you share that concern? Do you think that's likely?
I think any politician who's thinking about changing the Iowa system based on what looks to be, you know, their benefit in the short term, had better be careful because we do see the winds of politics change. Who's in the legislature every, you know, two, four, maybe as long as 6 years. So if Republicans want to change that, they better beware that Democrats may very well take over the legislature down the road and also occupy the governor's mansion. What we have in Iowa is the best system in all of America. It is entirely nonpartisan. It's in the hands of a commission. And in fact, when they draw those boundaries, they paid absolutely no attention whatsoever to where the current incumbents live. Jim Leach, you know, in 2001, moved from Davenport to Iowa City because of the redistricting. I moved from Mount Vernon to Iowa City. I lost one county out of 15, Linn County, and I gained 10 more. And I wanted to continue to represent those 14 counties that were in that new district. This is the best way to do it. I think all of America should do it. We would avoid what happens in other states. You know, in Illinois, the Democrats have run it. They've gained seats. In Texas, the Republicans have run it. They've gained seats in the U.S. House. Gerrymandering is not the way to go, no matter which party does it.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back and have you give us a little bit of a long view of your time in office. You mentioned Jim Leach. You upset Jim Leach in 2006, widely described as a moderate Republican. He had something like 15 terms in the U.S. House. So 2006, the wind was at the Democrats' backs, 2 years away from Obama being elected president. Now the wind very much in your face. What kind of soul-searching are you and other Democrats doing in the face of this devastating loss in 2016?
Well, I'm leading something called a Building Blocks Project. You know, I am the only Democrat left in the federal delegation, as you said, but that was the case 2 years ago as well. So this is two terms in a row where I'm the only Democrat left in the delegation. And Democrats lost the Iowa Senate as well. So everything is in Republican hands except my seat. And I believe it's important for me to lead the way to do what I can to try to find out what happened the last couple of cycles here in the state of Iowa, why Democrats lost.
What are your conclusions so far? With Donald Trump winning by something like 10 points in Iowa?
Yeah, 9.5 points, that's right. Look, I think it's the case that that a lot of people simply didn't see people where they, as I say, live, work, and play. This is something I've done since I've been in office, whether I had 15 counties or now 24 counties, what I'm doing today. I'm going to get out and I'm going to talk to people where they work and where they live and where they play and listen to them. And what I have found is even when we disagree with each other, even when they know, for example, that I'm not necessarily going to vote the way that they want me to vote, even after they make their best case and we have a conversation about it, there's still a mutual respect there. And I think that's what a lot of people didn't feel this last time around. I think that does explain some of the losses. But we've got to do a more systematic study of this instead of just looking at it anecdotally. And that's what we're talking about. We're moving forward on that in the next month.
Would the Democrats have done better all around with a different name at the top of the ticket, a Bernie Sanders instead of a Hillary Clinton?
I think that's unknowable. I really don't think we have any idea whether that would have been the case or not. I do believe that Donald Trump tapped into an anger and a frustration that was not recognized by a lot of Democrats along the way. That's something I saw. That's something I recognized. That's something I told Democrats we ought to be recognizing. Again, understanding and realizing that just recognizing a problem and acknowledging someone's pain isn't necessarily going to lead to agreement between the two of you as to how best to deal with that. But I think that's the first step, and I think that's really important.
Mm-hmm. Democrats are not in control of the House, the U.S. House, or the Senate. So where do you see areas of common ground with you and the Republicans in
You know, for me, I have these 24 counties, and I go from Clinton on the Mississippi down to Keokuk on the Mississippi, and then I go all the way on the Missouri border over to Lamoni, to Interstate 35, back up to Jasper County, and back over to the east. It's a rural district in large measure. Yes, I have Iowa City. Yes, I have Davenport, but it's largely a rural district. So much of what I do when I'm in Congress is I partner with Republicans from rural district as well as Democrats, but Republicans to deal with education in rural areas, to deal with health policy in rural areas. I'll be visiting a number of hospitals at the end of this week in my district as well. Dealing with rural broadband issues, that's economic development, that's education, trying to deal with the homework gap for kids who can't get online because they don't have bandwidth, those kinds of issues. When I got reelected this time, and I went back in November and in December, I went across the aisle, as I often do, and I talked to my Republican colleagues dealing with these issues, dealing with community pharmacy issues, dealing with a number of things that affect rural America in particular. And I said, look, I understand you guys have complete control. I still want to work with you as the lead Democrat on the issues we've worked on. Some of them came to me and asked me to do that. I went to some of them and said, I'm willing to do it. That's what I continue to do. Where we're going to have our differences, and it's going to be really hard to overcome the differences, we'll be dealing with the big issues like Social Security and Medicare. I'm never going to vote to privatize Social Security. I'm not going to vote to voucherize Medicare and turn it over to the private insurance companies. And as far as the Affordable Care Act is concerned, if they can demonstrate to me that they've got better ideas and that whatever their plan is, and again, I haven't seen a full plan yet, you know, is at least as good, if not better, than the Affordable Care Act, then I'll be open to that. I mean, what I hear, though, from most folks is they want to repair it, they want to fix it, they don't want to repeal it.
U.S. Representative Dave Loebsack from Iowa's 2nd District, thank you for coming in for this conversation.
As always, thanks, Ben. Appreciate it.
Coming up, a conversation with University of Iowa political scientist Bill Reisinger. He'll give us a Russian perspective on the latest revelations involving the Kremlin and President Trump. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River. We'll be back in just a moment. Thank you.